This is Yo Rocco.
Because the reality is that people have very busy lives. And pastors do too, but this is our job.
Hey, this is Rocky. You're listening to the Yo Rocco podcast, my weekly conversation with interesting people about their interesting projects. Thanks for listening. This week I talked with Bill Hobbicht, who is a pastor in Davis, California, who I have known for about 15 years but haven't heard from for well over a decade. Bill and I were part of the same group of young adult volunteers in the Presbyterian Church in 1998 and 1999. If you don't know about it, the Presbyterian Church has a great program where post-college young adults can go do a year of volunteer service, and Bill and I did that in the same year. He went to Ghana and I went to Northern Ireland. And we saw each other at a retreat once we got back, but that was the end of it. I haven't seen Bill for well over a decade, and little did I know, we've kind of been on parallel tracks. He went off to seminary like I did shortly after we got back, and we've both been ordained into the Presbyterian Church and have been working in the PCUSA for about 10 years. I recently got connected to Bill again when I was working on a conference and somebody suggested him as a speaker, and I'm really glad that they did. Bill is a really thoughtful, really creative pastor and leader who's working on some truly innovative things in his ministry. He is working on a coffee and tea social enterprise in Davis. He has recently created helped to create a co-working space in that community's downtown district by partnering with a real estate developer. So he has some really interesting things to describe and thought-provoking philosophies about leadership. And this was a really interesting conversation. I'm glad that he took the time, and I hope that you enjoy it as well. So here is Bill Hobbicht.
Well, you're a busy guy. I appreciate you taking time to talk to me. It was really great to get reconnected to you through this conference back in March. I hadn't seen or heard from you for about 15 years, and then up pops this name as a recommended speaker at this conference, and I said, oh, I totally know that guy. We have to get him.
Yeah, it was a great conference.
Yeah, and your presentation was really, really thought-provoking. I've thought a lot about it since then, and most of what I want to talk to you about today was stuff that was in that presentation.
Okay, sounds good.
Well, let me start with this. So the website of the Davis Community Church, where you're the associate pastor, right? Describes you in the very first sentence as a common good and social media conspirator. And I was just wondering if you could tell me what that is.
Sure. Well, the common good, borrowed that language from Walter Brueggemann in his book, Journey to the Common Good, where he spends a lot of time talking about basically redefining what worship is. And his view, I think, in general, is that worship is not just about sitting down in a church in some pews or chairs and singing some songs and hearing a great message, but is more reflective of Isaiah 58 that really talks about helping people to find freedom. So that's where the common good comes in. And I've also found when working with non-religious entities like the business community or universities, that common good is something that they can buy into. Doesn't come with doctrine attached to it. So that's why I use the term the common good.
Okay.
And then the social media conspirator is really more of a nod to recognize that we live in a different age of communication where social media and the internet serve as a platform to form community.
Okay. And that is kind of a conspiratorial platform. I mean, the word conspirator implies like subversion.
Yeah, well, I think you're connecting with people you wouldn't typically connect with. Sometimes even, be associated with folks. So it's a platform where conversation across different belief systems can occur. And I think in many ways that is kind of a conspiratory approach to things.
So your work finds you rubbing shoulders and cooperating and conspiring with lots of different kinds of people from lots of different kinds of faith traditions and even from outside faith traditions, right?
Yeah, definitely.
It almost seems like that's the norm for what you do.
Yeah, I think so. I guess I thrive on it. It helps me in my own faith development, but to hear different perspectives and to work toward finding common ground.
Okay. So the most prominent project that I know of that you're involved in doing that is the Mosaic Tea and Coffee project that you described at the conference in Chicago, and that in the TED talk that you gave a couple, was that in the last year or 2 years ago? How long ago was that?
I've done two of them, so I'm not sure which one you're referring to.
Okay, well, I've seen the one that I've seen is the one where you talked about the common good for crowdsourcing for shared spaces.
Right, right.
And at the end of that, you introduced this barn raising Davis website where community ideas were going to be shared and voted on and then implemented, and one of those was Mosaic Tea and Coffee.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean that was it's more of a proof of concept than anything else. But it was a new way to engage the wider community. Mosaic Tea and Coffee was just the example we threw up there. But the idea is, we often talk about open table in the church, but often open table means open table to those that are part of the club. So crowdsourcing really opens it up to the entire community. It doesn't matter where you're coming from. And that's the model we've used for Mosaic Tea and Coffee as well. We have a core group of leaders, and even though this is a quote church program, the majority of the leadership is from outside the church.
That's interesting. But I think I read this, that the two people who started talking that got the idea going are both part of your church community, right?
Yeah, the idea arose through conversation in the park across the street with a church member who worked with adults with disabilities, and she was talking about how her clients are thriving because they're in job training and placement programs, but once they reach the age of 21, that program is no longer available to them. And then quality of life just sort of goes downhill. So that's where the idea of Mosaic Tea and Coffee began.
Yeah, and so Mosaic Tea and Coffee is a coffee shop that is also a job training program for adults with disabilities. We're talking about developmental disabilities, physical disabilities. Do you guys make a distinction?
No, we keep it as broad as possible. So it could be physical, it could be psychological, it could be developmental. We're trying to keep it as broad as possible. We really view disabilities on a spectrum and talk more about temporarily able-bodied. Recognizing that as we age, everyone encounters a disability of some sort.
Yeah. So you've got a pretty wide group of people who are coming to work at Mosaic Tea and Coffee. I mean, is it actually open now? Is it running?
No, it's not running yet. We're in the midst right now of designing our crowdfunding campaign and getting some final bids for things like flooring. But we hope to, and then we're filling out some grant applications right now. So depending on how much money we raise, a target for opening would be maybe January or February of 2016.
Okay. And the other really unique thing about Mosaic Tea and Coffee is that it's a pay-it-forward business model. People come in and pay what they can. There's no set prices for things. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. We felt like the focus of Mosaic Tea and Coffee job training was good. The focus on building community and breaking down societal barriers was good. But we also want to make it inclusive, and that includes making it inclusive to everyone in the economic strata, the different strata. So we're approaching this as a gift economy. So people are invited in, and they're offered a bill after they order something of $0. At that point, they're invited to pay it forward for the next person. And what this does is it opens it up to someone who's a lawyer to order the same thing as someone who's living in Section 8 housing. And they just pay different amounts from what they have. If someone only has a quarter and they're like, I want to do something else to contribute, we'll have volunteer opportunities where they can plug in and contribute to the community.
Okay. The first thing that I thought of when I heard that business model described was that that's going to be a lot harder to get the lawyers, as you said, interested than it will everybody else. I saw a little video recently that somebody made where they sat down on the sidewalk like they were panhandling, but they were actually trying to give people money. And when they did that, people got irate. They were furious at the idea that somebody was presuming to give them money like they looked like they needed it. Are you thinking that's going to be a thing to overcome for Mosaic Tea and Coffee at all, that people who can afford to go spend $4.50 on a latte at Starbucks will choose to do that instead of come and do this other thing?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that's going to be an issue. You know, the focus is really just on building community. And at least in our town, you know, the coffee shops are really set up for the hard tables rather close together. So we're offering a different type of environment, focusing on tea. So really we're trying to get people to come in and to slow down. And I think that appeals to a lot of people, especially in a highly achievement-oriented academic town such as Davis.
Right. So what's the physical space going to do to make them slow down? How's it going to be laid out?
Well, first, our product of tea. You know, you get a pot of tea, but you have to let it steep. We're going to have tables like you would in any cafe, but we're also going to have couches with little tables next to them so people can sit down and join in conversation. Right now, most cafes here in town are coffee shops. They're just small tables. People come in, do work, and then leave.
Right.
So it's just kind of setting up the environment differently.
Okay. Well, it sounds like a cozy environment. It sounds like the kind of place I'd like to hang out. I'm a coffee drinker. I'm not so much of a tea drinker, but you are going to have good coffee, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Have you worked, who you're going to get it from?
There's a company, I think they're up in Oregon, called Happy Cup. Okay. And they work with the best roaster in Oregon who works with them, and the employees all have disabilities.
Huh. What's it called again?
Happy Cup.
Happy Cup. I have to look into that, maybe put a link to that when I post this. You talk a lot about building community as an explicit goal of what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's a goal that I share. But what I find over and over again is it doesn't work the way that I think it should, or there are very specific mechanics that you have to pay attention to in order to build community. Talk a little bit about the things that you're finding you have to actually do well for community to be the result of your efforts.
That's a good question. You know, part of it is we're going to have to experiment and fail and learn from the process and then move on from there. Some key components we hope to build into this to help with that is storytelling.
Mm.
A key one. The art of storytelling is really lost in our culture right now. And so we want to provide a space where we get one or two individuals from the community to share some deep and emotional stories from their lives. For example, and maybe do it over an hour period, so each speaker would speak for 30 minutes. They'd be given a topic such as, tell us a story about loss and new life. And I think when people share these deep stories from their lives, that helps to build community. I think that the nature of the coffee shop lends itself to people volunteering, working together. You know, we started a shelter program here quite a few years ago, just with a small handful of churches, and now it's thriving. You know, there's over 40 groups in the community participating, 1,700 volunteers, no one's paid. And I think that all arose, that community arose, because people could come and kind of participate in a singular goal, which was building beloved community. And people are interested in that.
And also that the shelter, is that rotating shelter that goes around in the wintertime?
Yeah, it rotates.
The that also has an external goal, though, too. The goal is to house people who are otherwise out on the streets. And so one of the things that I wonder about, and I wonder if you can comment on this, is when you say that your goal is to build community, there are barriers that you deal with when that you don't deal with when your goal is to do some other thing really well and community being built is the byproduct. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so it depends. That's right. So the coffee shop, it's really a mechanism. And in many ways, the shelter is a mechanism as well. It could have been many different things to meet the needs of individuals living homeless. shelter being a provision, but the underlying goal really is about building beloved relationships with one another. So if you were to walk into the shelter, it's great that we provide shelter. People are very thankful. But I'd say more than that, the guests that are staying there, the volunteers that participate, is that they have this opportunity to enter in relationship with one another that doesn't really exist anywhere in society. And I think that that's probably what makes it so successful. So the same thing can be said about Mosaic Tea and Coffee.
Yeah.
Whether we serve tea or coffee or whether we open up a shoe store and sell shoes, that's just a mechanism where a community can form a contrast.
Yeah. And I wonder about the quality of the product as a thing that draws community. I mean, some of the coffee shops that I've been around that I really think are great and that seem to me to have like a really lively sense of community in them are places that are sort of known for the quality of what they do as much as for the physical space or the atmospherics and the sense of community.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we've talked a lot about product. We sampled various roasters for the coffee. We've tried different purveyors of tea, and we're trying to choose the ones that are super high quality. And we're also focusing on where's our niche in terms of product. There's only one small tea shop in town, so that's why we're primarily focusing on tea. And then we're also focusing on gluten-free products. So if you walk in, you won't really be able to buy a gluten-based product. So those are kind of the niches we're looking at.
Out here, I don't know what it's like. I mean, I'm in Southern California. You're in Northern California. In Southern California, the niche in coffee, at least right now, is pour-over coffees that are more expensive than anything on the menu. A single cup of coffee that is poured over is like $6.
Yeah, it's I find it quite humorous myself.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. It's Intellihensia Coffee down here is the one that really kind of pioneered that. But well, or maybe not pioneered it, but is really well known for it. This is a social enterprise. That's the term you use for it. That's the term that when you address the Next Church conference in Chicago last March, your whole presentation was about social enterprises as a model for the church. So just briefly explain, what's a social enterprise and how's it different from a nonprofit?
Okay. So social enterprises, well, nonprofits, they depend largely on the generosity of people. So the budget is made up of donations. A social enterprise is operates like a business with the values of a nonprofit. So it takes the thought processes of business and develops an actual business and uses a business model to operate. So instead of depending upon donations and people being generous, you're offering a product in return. And the great thing about this is, A, it's self-sustaining. It doesn't fluctuate as much once you get a solid base of customers. And B, it can be scaled. So if your business is successful, you can reinvest the money back into it and create a greater impact in kind of the social justice issues that we focus on.
Whereas if you're running a nonprofit and you have excess revenue, that's not the idea. That's not the goal.
That's right. I mean, what are you reinvesting in? Right? We're reinvesting in the business. So if Mosaic Tea and Coffee becomes wildly successful, we can almost franchise out and open up another shop in another community, and provide the startup funding for it, and there you expand the social impact.
And it has an explicitly social purpose for existing. It's not doing something socially conscious as a part of its business plan. That is its business plan.
Yeah, it's the core of it. So typically social enterprises look at, hold up three things. People is number one, planet is number two, profit is number three. So it kind of inverts the typical business model in that sense. It's not about first off, making a lot of money. It's about people first. So that's the focus.
But it also has profit in the calculation, which for the traditional nonprofit person or church person, profit has never really been part of the calculation. I think we've just kind of assumed that, well, there's not going to be any profit. We have to learn how to subsist on generosity and donations.
Yeah, in many ways, I think that's a unfortunate model that's developed over time, where making profit is seen as counter to making social impact. You know, the reality is that the more profit that you make, the more money you have available, the greater impact you can have in your community.
So what are some examples that you use of social enterprises that are doing this right?
Warby Parker is a good one. Warby Parker makes glasses. They're super affordable, high quality.
Glasses like eyewear?
Eyewear. You haven't heard of Warby Parker?
No, I'm not very cool. I don't know if you know that, but
Warby Parker. So you can look that up.
Okay.
And they have a great business model. Not only do they donate eyeglasses that they have attached to each purchase, but they also take a revenue that they have and invest in entrepreneurs in two-third world countries. So they basically help start businesses in Africa, in South America, wow, providing training, product. So it's a great example of a social enterprise in my opinion.
Okay. You're trying some crowdfunding to raise money. Is that
right?
Is that what you have to do as a social enterprise? I mean, is there just no chance that like people who are going to fund just straight up businesses are going to be that interested in a social enterprise?
You mean from the business community?
Yeah.
Well, business community is a little tight right now, at least in our town. We're going to be going after all different kinds of funding. We're trying to figure it out as we go along. So we'll be doing, you know, creative fundraisers, crowdfunding, grants through the Presbyterian Church, through other grant streams. So we're taking a very holistic approach to funding. Crowdfunding is the first one we're really going to try to undertake though, so that we can get the word out about Mosaic and get more people involved.
Okay, so there's some of those pillars of nonprofit fundraising are still part of what you have to do.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's just for the startup phase. You know, we have a business plan with all the financial calculations, and a very modest calculation is that we should be making profit within 1.7 years.
Okay.
And so we really just need startup funding.
Yeah, I looked over that. I looked over that business plan on the Mosaic Tea and Coffee website. It's very detailed, and it says at the end you acknowledge a company in Colorado that gave you some help with that. Is that right?
Yeah, Steamers Coffee.
So they're doing the same kind of thing.
Yeah, they're not officially a social enterprise. They're a straight up business.
Okay.
That employed individuals with disabilities. So ours is more of a hybrid.
Interesting. So the crowdfunding piece, that's something that I think a lot of people in churches that I talk to are starting to experiment with. Mm-hmm. Another one of the presenters at that conference that we were at in March was a guy who did a whole thing on crowdfunding platforms for
yes,
churches. And so I'm taking a group of kids on a mission trip to Denver this summer, and one of them set up a GoFundMe page.
Right.
I've bought things and contributed through Kickstarter campaigns. One of my favorite bands is trying to make a new record, and I'm trying to decide if I should contribute to that on Indiegogo. It's pretty pervasive.
Yes.
Are you learning some of the things that you have to do really well in order to have a successful crowdfunding campaign and to use those tools well?
Yeah, I mean, we do a lot of reading and research on it. You know, one of the biggest pieces is that it really has to speak to someone's heart for something like this. So right now, we're about to enter into the video, you know, creating the video. And we're going to be talking with members of our own leadership team as well as the community, folks that have a disability, and really asking them why a program like this is important to them. You know, in our core team, one of the individuals is blind. She also doesn't have great hearing, yet she has her law degree and passed the bar exam. She still can't find a job.
Yeah.
So kind of hearing that story, and this is about investing in people, you know, we hope that will speak to people on a profound way.
Okay, so you have to speak to someone's heart when you're running a crowdfunding campaign. It's got to have an emotional appeal. What else?
I have to go back and look over all the information. I mean,
the reason I ask is because the first time I tried this, you know, we put a thing up for a mission trip and said, help us go on our mission trip, and we shared the link around and nothing happened. And I thought, well, this must not work. But of course, the reality is it does work. You just have to, it's like any other tool, you have to know how to use it properly.
Yeah, you have to tell a compelling story. You know, I think it's a big one. You'll probably also contact a bunch of people ahead of time to say, hey, this is coming out. You know, it'd be great if you all can make a donation the first day just to get the ball rolling.
You said tell a compelling story.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And then some advance notification for people so that it doesn't just go up and then you start sharing the link around, but people know that it's coming.
Yeah, I think that's probably what we're going to do. We have, you know, we have our faith community, we have the region, we have the national church. Then we have, you know, which most churches don't, we have this huge network of nonprofit providers that are involved in this. So we're going to ask them to publicize to their constituents as well. So we'll send out, you know, publicity ahead of time and then let everyone know when it goes live.
Yeah, it sounds like you have a pretty diverse team of people working on this project.
Yeah, it is diverse.
Did all those people get involved through invitations from you?
No, not just from me. They just, you know, a lot of them happen organically. So one of our key people on the team is an older woman. She has mobility issues, so she's in an electric wheelchair. And I met her on the bus. And since that time, she's been, you know, meeting other people in town. She's a networker and finding all sorts of people to join in this effort.
Well, I'm eager to see what happens with it. You said you're anticipating that January of 2016 might be a launch date.
Yeah, it would be earlier, but our sanctuary is going under renovation, so our congregation is going to be in the space for Mosaic Tea and Coffee. We have to wait till they move back into the sanctuary before we can actually renovate the space.
Oh yeah, I totally forgot to ask you about that. It's actually going to be in your church space.
Yeah, we have a huge fellowship hall. I'd say it's 3,400 square feet, almost cavernous, with an industrial kitchen. So it's going to be in there. That space is used 12% of the time right now. And so it's one of our greatest resources as we're a downtown church.
Yeah.
It's underutilized, so we're hoping that this will be a better use of that space.
And the only thing you really have to lay out as far as capital expenses for that is some new flooring, you said?
Well, we also have to buy equipment.
You're not just going to need the equipment in the kitchen? The 60-year-old oven?
We actually have a pretty good oven. We need coffee makers, we need teapots, teacups, so that will be another way people can give, and some have already, is we used Amazon Smile.
We donate
a portion for each first purchase, and you know we've identified items that people can go ahead and purchase and donate to us.
So the Amazon Smile thing, you get registered as a recipient on there, right? And then people can designate a portion of their purchase to you?
I think it's like 1% of each sale goes to a nonprofit of your choice.
Right.
So what would happen is, you know, you could go on and buy us 6 coffee mugs. Send us the coffee mugs, we get that plus the 1% donation.
That's a whole other possibility of getting things paid for that most of the times you wouldn't even consider.
Yeah. We're trying different approaches.
Well, every time I log on to Amazon now, it asks me if I want to go to Amazon Smile instead. So Amazon's really pushing it.
Yeah, they are. I mean, it's good PR for them. So next time you go on there, register, but select Davis Community Church Rocky.
All right. I'll do that. I'm serious. You mentioned the coffee makers and the need to have those. And I went 3 or 4 years ago to the coffee shop, the coffee roaster here locally that I really like, and I wanted to talk to that guy who runs it about maybe getting their coffee to use at our church for our coffee hours. And he asked me, well, what do you use to brew your coffee on Sunday? And I said, well, we have these big, like, you know, 30-gallon percolators.
Uh-huh, and he
said, nope. You're not putting my coffee in that. That was the end of the conversation.
That's perfect. Yeah, we're getting some that are, I think, will be more appealing to coffee connoisseurs.
Yeah.
Or roasters.
But even so, there's all kinds of other stuff that you have to address. I mean, this same guy, a couple years later, actually gave us a coffee brewer that was like industrial and plugged into a water line, and he gave it to us, and I was thrilled. And then we got it into our kitchen and asked our property committee, okay, what will it cost to get the water line connected to this? And it was like $800 or $900. It was far more than the coffee machine would have cost itself, and so we didn't even use that.
Yeah, we're gonna have to. We do have some structural things we're gonna have to do. Building a coffee tea bar, display case for the baked goods, and then one of the biggest costs we have actually is renovating the kitchen, because as it stands right now, someone in a wheelchair can't reach the counters. So there's a lot of adapting we're going to have to do in the kitchen area.
Thanks for listening to the Oroco podcast and my conversation this week with Bill Hobbicht. Bill's working on a lot of interesting things, and I appreciated the chance to ask him about those projects. But I also was really interested in talking to him about why he leads the way that he does. And in the second half of this conversation, you'll hear that he's got some pretty challenging things to say about the way leadership is conceived of in the church, broadly speaking. Bill doesn't describe himself to people in the community as a pastor when he first meets them. He says he's a nonprofit leader. That's actually his email signature. And he gets a lot of pushback in the congregation that he serves for that. But that is an indicator of the way that he leads and how he's trying to position himself in the community to work for the common good, is a phrase that means a lot to him. So thanks again for listening, and enjoy now the second half of my conversation with Bill Hobbicht. Well, I'm interested in you as a leader and as a person who is doing projects like this. And is this approach, embracing, you know, the role of a social media conspirator, embracing crowdfunding, that kind of thing, is this something that has emerged over time for you, or is this just kind of always the way that you've worked, even before you were in ordained ministry?
No, I think I came out fairly traditional. Didn't know what to expect in ministry, and I guess it's been more, and it still is, a process of exploration. And I guess the hardest step was moving to a place where I was willing to fail and embrace that. And instead of having a full-fledged plan with every detail marked out, to get an idea, you know, share it with other people, see if there's interest, and then just start trying it.
Okay.
And, you know, it sort of led to a different approach in ministry, I guess you would say.
And that piece about being willing to fail, I feel like, comes up a lot. You can't read anything about creative leadership or creating change in organizations without coming across the sentiment that you have to be willing to fail. But that usually is not followed by illustrations from people about what has actually failed for them. So what are some things that have failed?
Well, I mean, I can talk about a big project that failed a few years ago. We tried a social enterprise. It was with the homeless community. Spent about a year and a half working on it. We were looking at starting a yard care business. And pulled in all sorts of experts from the university. Pulled in some folks from the food cooperative here in town. We brought all sorts of information about member cooperatives and food cooperatives and all these different models. And that project completely failed for a number of reasons. One is we decided to go and really try to pull in the best and brightest academic scholars.
Uh-huh.
And as we found out, theory is one thing, application is another. And then the second thing we learned is that it's not enough just to pull together people that are passionate. You really have to be looking at skill sets when forming a leadership team. That was the other piece. So, you know, that project absolutely failed. And it was probably the first time where I was like, you know what, let's just call it for what it is. It's a failure. Now what can we learn from this? And so we took those lessons into Mosaic Tea and Coffee, and really looked at who needs to be on our leadership team with the skill sets, people who can discuss, who can discern, and then not just look at academics, but look at pragmatic models. So that's why we contacted like the tea shop in Colorado and said, well, what actually worked when you're setting up your tea and coffee shop?
Yeah. Well, a year and a half is a long time to work on something.
It is. I don't like to give up.
I don't like to give up. It feels like there's a couple different narratives at work in that whole, you know, be willing to fail thing. Because on the other side of that is the model of a leader who doesn't, like you said, doesn't like to give up and is just tenacious and will see the thing through anyway, anyhow. So with that lawn care business idea, how did you know, okay, this is dead?
Well, we started having fluctuations in attendance. People were just getting frustrated and angry. And so I guess it's more paying attention to the energy. Even with Mosaic Tea and Coffee, we reached a point, we had lots of internal barriers within our own faith community to overcome, wore down a lot of people. So even after it was approved, everyone was exhausted. So at that point, we decided to take a sabbatical as a group, which lasted for quite a while. And then we came back and reassessed and said, you know, is it time to disband, or do people feel like they've had a rest and they're ready to give it another go? And the group decided they wanted to give it another go.
And Mosaic Tea and Coffee is the other go.
It is the other go.
All right.
I mean, we eat Mosaic Tea and Coffee, we went through that process where we took the sabbatical. After getting approval and then came back a few months ago.
You talked about paying attention to the energy of the group. That's a thing that for me and my colleague at the church in Claremont, energy is something that we kind of check in on first when there's an idea or a project. It often happens that, you know, somebody will come to either her or me and say, we should do this. And we'll say, okay, go find some people who have energy for that. And then come back, and we'll figure out how to do it. And 9 times out of 10, they don't come back.
Right.
And
right.
I guess the challenge is, you know, you question that way of doing things. You question, is anything ever going to get done leading this way? I mean, if it just seems to happen again and again that one person has an idea and they come to you to do it, and then you say, no, I'm not going to do it, but if you get some people who have energy for it, I'll help you do it, and then nothing happens, you kind of feel like, well, how's this ever going to work? But you've seen it actually work.
Yeah, except I don't believe that. I don't believe that model, so I don't necessarily approach it that way.
You don't believe the model of, like, having people go find others who are energized about it as well?
No, I think if that person has energy and it seems to be in alignment with, you know, the vision, the values of the congregation, I just don't send them out to go find people. I kind of take on that role with them. So it's kind of a two people going parallel. Because the reality is that people have very busy lives. And pastors do too, but this is our job, really work towards the common good of the entire community. So, you know, I guess I view my calling as, if there's anyone that needs to take responsibility for trying to get something going, it would be the pastor. I know we talk a lot about lay leadership, but I found that it's better for the pastor to partner with someone if it looks like a really promising idea, help to lead it, and then once it starts gaining energy and going and the ball's rolling, that's when you start pulling back and serve more as a... Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, what if it doesn't look like a promising idea to you? How do you tell that person either, you know, this doesn't really look like a fully formed idea to me, or, you know, it's not something that I personally have a lot of energy for?
I just tell them that. That's it. I would say, the idea looks good. You know, it doesn't really speak to me on a deep level. I can send out a couple of emails and see if people are interested. Or I can say, the basic idea looks good, but, you know, can you do a little bit more research in this area, or go, you know, look out this area? In many ways, it's like you're a development worker.
Huh.
You know, and so if I were in real estate, I would say, the idea of that building looks good, but I'm going to need more details in it, or give me a purpose for the building. That's what I
do. But you're still going to put that on the on that person who's come to you with the idea. You're not going to take that on yourself and go do all that extra research.
No, I wouldn't go do all the extra research. That would be their job. But to just put it back on them to you know, someone who's working a full-time job saying, well, this looks good, go out and do it, I don't think that's enough these days.
Clearly not. I definitely think that the level of energy that people have in congregations for new kinds of ministries is probably less than it was in generations before. I mean, that may be wrong, but it seems to me that people are overworked and tired in a way that is worse than before. So to say to them, yeah, you got to go do it, and then I'll cheer for you. I mean, I totally agree with you that that's not a great. You're not going to get anything done that way. But what I struggle with is the feeling that I've got 5 or 6 or 7 projects that I'm trying to help people get off the ground, and maybe 1 or 2 of them are things that I'm really excited about, and the rest to me isn't really, you know, lighting the fire. But it's my job to try to help them do it. And so the default for me is go find some other people who want to do this with you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard place to be in, but I think, you know, ultimately that as pastors we should be modeling what we would hope for other people. Right, so if we espouse that people should be following their call and being true to that and following the things that they're passionate about, that has to apply to us as well. And it's a difficult conversation to have, but we have to be honest and say, you know, it doesn't really speak to me. They might speak to other people, but it doesn't speak to me. And you know, unfortunately, for that reason, it's not something I'm going to be investing my time in. Pastors are not just workforces. We're supposed to be modeling how you live out faith in a way that is life-giving and gives you energy.
So here's a scenario that I proposed to my colleague a couple weeks ago. We recently went through this New Beginnings assessment, which is a denominational tool for assessing the congregation and deciding on a future direction. And part of that is a coaching conversation over the phone with somebody, and we were both sitting in on this coaching conversation. And when that was over, Hugh and I were kind of debriefing what we needed to do next. And I kind of wondered out loud, are we as pastors supposed to be one participant in a community of people who are trying to lead in a different way? In other words, like, I have projects that I'm interested in working on. Some of them are in the congregation. Some of them are at the presbytery level. And I take ownership of those because they're important to me and I want certain outcomes. And I'm happy to have people come work on those with me, and I invite people to come work on those with me. But I think what I've been working with is an expectation that other people in the congregation who don't have this as their job would take the same level of ownership for things that they're interested in as well. And you're saying that's not really realistic.
Well, I mean, I guess it's just a matter of time and resources, really. You know, I would hope that if they're super passionate about it, and I'm not, I guess my job would be give them 2 or 3 names of people they can try to connect with who I think might have the energy or have the same interest area, so you're networking with that. But I'm not really interested in seeking my time and energy in something that doesn't give me life. I mean, I'm not passionate about it. I don't think I'm being true to myself or about a good model of faith, really.
Yeah. Well, how often an occurrence is it in the culture that you're serving in that people come to you with these ideas? I mean, is it having an effect, like people seeing you take on these kinds of new projects and things? Are you finding that multiplies the people who are coming to you with their own ideas?
Yeah. And people that are willing to kind of feel called and have the energy and passion to lead it. So, for example, last week, or 2 weeks ago, someone came into my office. You know, homelessness is a big topic right now, housing and homelessness. And she said, you know, I read this book, Tent City Urbanism, from self-organized camps to tiny house villages up in Portland. And they said, I would think I want to start working on this to see if we can create kind of this co-housing environment, tiny houses for individuals living homeless. So I'm passionate about homelessness, right? I don't have the time right now to sink into it, so my job right then is just a connector with different people in the community. I have more people coming from outside the church with their ideas than inside the church at this point.
That's really interesting to me, and that's where I want to take the conversation next, because you you've done two TED Talks, and you you're not talking to a church audience, you're talking to the community there in Davis, you're talking to a public of which the church is a part, but it's a different kind of conversation, and you're inviting people to collaborate with you for the common good, but not as the church, right? So what I mean, like, what are some of the kind of things that people are coming to you from the community wanting to do? And is the fact that you're a clergy person, it doesn't weird people out, clearly. Like, it's not keeping them from coming to you.
Well, I have a certain profile in town. You know, it's been developed over quite a few years. As someone who doesn't lead with doctrine, it's just interested in the common good. So that's something that's been nurtured over time. But I do take small steps, you know, which I receive flack for in our church. So my email signature, for example, it says nonprofit leader. It doesn't say pastor. It doesn't say associate pastor. It does have the name of the church, but I put nonprofit leader for that exact reason, is it carries a lot of baggage. So, which isn't a problem. Once people get to know me and we get to know each other and have a relationship, and they find out I'm a pastor, it's not a problem because we know each other already. It's just the initial interactions.
And you get pushback from the congregation for that?
That I have nonprofit leader instead of associate pastor.
And if Mosaic Tea and Coffee is a rousing success, you're going to have to put social enterprise leader.
I guess.
I take your point that one of the things that you're explicitly trying to do is build really good working relationships with community leaders for the common good.
Yeah.
That strikes me as different even from the missional church stuff, where the idea of a pastor being out in the community with really great working relationships with other organizations and other leaders in the community would be in some way for the sake of growing their congregation. And is that part of the calculation at all for you?
To be honest, I don't really care about the growth of the congregation. I think that that's the wrong goal. I think what what I try to do is pretty simple. My theology seemed to be so complex coming out of seminary, and now it seems so basic. Maybe I'm dumbing down a little bit. But I think I just see my calling and my role as trying my best to uphold and lead a life following the footsteps of Jesus. So that's really, it's pretty basic. If the congregation grows, I think that's great. But I would rather, you know, be a person who's able to develop community to achieve some social objectives that address issues of human flourishing. So we have a huge issue, I think, around the globe is this sense of loneliness and disconnectedness. So if we're able to create some spaces, and the mechanism doesn't matter, whether it's a tea shop or whether it's an artist collective, which is something we did earlier, or something else, that's just the mechanism. If we're able to address issues of human flourishing and provide a space where people don't have to be lonely, then I think that's living out our faith.
It almost sounds like if you weren't in a church, you'd still be doing these things.
I would still be doing these things, yes. But the driving, you know, the driving force and is the meta-narrative of the Bible, which is one that talks about overcoming societal barriers, providing alternative community. So that's kind of my grounding, my foundation from which I move.
You talked in that in the first TED Talk that you did, the one that I saw, about your time in Ghana the year right after college, as one of the hardest periods in your life, where nobody spoke English and you were very, very lonely. It sounds like your sensitivity to kind of the human condition in our era of loneliness and siloization and disconnection from one another, your sensitivity to that seems to kind of stem from that experience in Ghana. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, there were two really formational, I would say primarily two formational periods in my life. The first one was in college. I lived in a halfway house with 11 ex-offenders, and my job was to help them reintegrate into society. And I really got an inside look at how unforgiving society is to mistakes that people made early in life. That kind of got me on the social justice route, and it was really about redefining community to broaden it and help people overcome those barriers. And then the second one, again, you know, is Ghana, like you identified. And I experienced loneliness at a level I didn't know was possible. And I also saw that someone's economic situation in life doesn't determine happiness. I mean, it was a subsistence farming village, and yet I would say it's probably the happiest place, the most content place I've ever lived. So I think those experiences certainly formed me into who I am today.
Yeah. I share your assessment about the, you know, high level of disconnection that people in our era feel and are living with. I have people that talk to me all the time who are not part of our congregation as well as those who are. Although I find people who aren't in the congregation more willing to talk to me about it than the ones who are. They'll say things like, there's something missing from my life or from our life as a family, some connection to something bigger than us, but you know, we're really busy and we don't know where that would come from. And it seems to me that the platforms that used to exist for people to connect to one another in community and to feel a sense of belonging, A, are mostly gone, but B, were pretty homogenous and not very welcoming to people who were different anyway.
Right.
So I guess what I'm getting at is it seems to me like we might have a fresh opportunity in the era we live in to create some new kinds of community spaces that are diverse and open and welcoming in a way that the old ones weren't. Do you think that's like foolhardy or like a real thing that could happen?
I think it's a real thing that can happen. I mean, I experience it on a micro level, you know, with these various projects that we've undertaken. We get such a diverse mix of people coming, and it's often folks you wouldn't expect to be meeting together. You know, but they sense this yearning, this deep yearning for something more, something deeper. So creating these spaces, I think, can absolutely happen. The church would be a great place to do that. You know, unfortunately, as much as we wish it weren't so, there is so much baggage that comes with walking in a church that I don't think people are willing to do it. So it's creating these alternative contexts that are new and don't have that baggage, I think, that has the best possibility for success.
So you're really investing in growing those new kinds of community spaces rather than transforming the church as a as an institution.
Yeah. You know, when I first came into the church, I was like, okay, I know it's a big ship. We can steer it. And it's nudged a little. You know, and there's been some shifts, at least in our congregation, but I don't think it's going to matter what we do. I think there's so much stigma and all kinds of things attached to the institutional church that our only chance for success is to plant a new seed and allow something organic to rise up. And it might not even look like a church in the eyes of the present congregation. In fact, I would say, they should be looking over and saying, I'm not sure that's really church. How far we need to move up there.
And you're trying to create spaces like this, obviously, with things like Mosaic Tea and Coffee, but are there other things that you're a part of or other things that you just see that give you hope that that's happening?
Yeah, you know, I partnered with a commercial real estate developer downtown, and we just opened a co-working space called Pollinate Davis.
Okay.
And just opened up 2 weeks ago. And
what is a co-working space?
A co-working space is shared collaborative workspace. So the idea is you provide space. We have different rooms. We have different private offices. We have a big room where people can come in and share big tables with other people to work. And then we have another room that has private desks. And the idea is you get a diverse cross-section of our community. So you have a marketer sitting next to a financial expert, sitting next to a startup person, sitting next to someone who's living homeless. You know, who writes a street newspaper, for example.
Right.
And people that would never sit next to each other, you know, working beside one another, because we like to silo people. And new community is formed in a way that hasn't happened before. Eventually, you know, my hope is that we start offering some classes to go deeper, to address that deeper yearning, such as storytelling. You know, maybe once a month we do a storytelling. Here's how I failed and came back. Or we can offer simple meals and often ask a question like, discuss at your table, what's the one value that guides your life and why? There's a lot of different things we can do to take people into the deeper dimensions of life.
And you seem confident that people want to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say, just as I'm sure you've had a gazillion conversations, people are yearning for that. They just don't know how to get there.
Yeah. I think the thing that is tripping me up is that repeatedly my efforts to try to do that with people, they kind of run away.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. People in the church or outside the church or both?
Well, both. I mean, so for an example, we have a preschool on our campus. It's part of our church. It's not like they rent space. The director is a church employee, and I've had several conversations with parents there when my daughter was in that preschool that are like the one I just described, where they say, you know, there's something missing from our life. There's got to be a way for us to get connected to a bigger community. And so we would try, you know, we would try events and things like that at the preschool, and we never got much of a turnout. What's happening now, and I think what maybe I'm learning is that it really revolves around a person. So there's a big difference between sending out a flyer and saying, hey, come to this community fair or to this kids activity or whatever at this date, at this time, versus an individual sitting out in front under like an easy up with like some lemonade and cookies and then just inviting you to sit down and talk with them, which our another person on our church staff has done that two or three times over the last couple of months. And she has kids in the preschool, and she's found that people are very willing to sit down and talk with her, and they're kids will play with each other there in the lawn on the lawn while they're having a conversation, and some things may grow out of that. But you know, the attempt to say, all right, people have a need, let's put an event in place to meet that need, I've almost given up on that.
Yeah, I think that's a typical approach, is to program. Take a programmatic approach, right?
Right. Rather than opposed to a relational approach.
Yeah, take a relational approach. You know, I think I really think it's about creating spaces of belonging. You know, Diana Butler-Bass talked about belonging quite a bit. But you've got to create spaces of belonging that aren't intended to pull people into the pews. You know? So that's the idea of the co-working space, is primarily to, first and foremost, to create a space of belonging. And leading up to that, you know, we working with this developer, we also set up like a networking event, where we have Ignite-style presentations, which is five, you know, people come in, do a five-minute presentation, slides rotate every 15 seconds automatically to build community. And what was so beautiful about it is we have like the CEO of this huge startup and highly successful standing next to the most socially awkward high school member of the robotics team, right? He doesn't really fit in anywhere. He fits in at the robotics team, but we get this huge standing next to like a jock, You know, we get this huge cross section here, and it's its own community already. And I think that there's something really beautiful about that. So, again, another space where people can belong.
Yeah, and that's explicitly what you're trying to do in Davis there. You are trying to create spaces where people can belong. And it, you know, the thing you just described, as well as a co-working space, those seem to be really good fits for people who are, you know, creative and maybe entrepreneurial and looking to collaborate with other people on stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. That's like you. I mean, these are the kinds of things that you would want to be part of.
Yeah, well, I self-select, right? I mean, I can't create, you know, I don't feel called to create spaces for belonging if I'm super uncomfortable. I don't feel like it's deeply seated within me.
Yeah.
You know, and people will see right through that. They'll see it's fabricated.
Yeah.
You know, so I guess part of it is just being true to yourself, Rocky.
What I was getting to was, you know, was this hunch that I've had about different things that people start, you know, people like yourself, and a lot of the people that I've talked to on this podcast are people who have started new projects, and it's always because there was something they wanted to participate in that doesn't exist, so they just said, all right, I'm going to make it, and if that's a community of people doing a certain thing, I'm going to gather people in that community for that purpose, rather than identifying a need outside of yourself and saying, I'm going to go solve that problem. The needs of the leader are deeply intertwined with the goals of what they're trying to accomplish socially.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. And to be honest, I think that's what younger generations are looking for. You know, there's even some research that backs it up, is that Gen Y, Gen Z even, they're not interested in just having a job. They're interested in having jobs with purpose. So I guess that's part of it, is just living into this job with purpose.
Yeah, and even within the realm of job, if you have one, to be looking at targeted projects that you can take on or undertake that that speak to your sense of purpose in the world and what you're trying to create. I mean, you have a job, but you don't work like somebody who has a job. My assessment is that you work like kind of like a freelancer. You've got multiple projects that you're working on there in Davis, and you have church responsibilities, sure, but your email says nonprofit leader, and you're partnering with lots of different kinds of people on things that you're interested in.
Yeah. It's not a typical route. It's not a very safe route at times.
Well, I wonder if it's not needed more and more. I mean, so here we are recording a podcast, and it's the middle of a work day, and you know, this is how I'm spending part of my work day.
Right.
And I'm fortunate to be working in a church community that's totally fine with that and likes that, actually. But not every place is like that. I wonder if that's going to become the norm, though.
I hope it will. You know, to a large degree, pastors are put in this role of being a manager, right, and maintaining what is. And I think if the church really is going to thrive and new expression to rise up, the church needs to do a self-assessment and say, do we really need 2 or 3 or 4 managers? You know, what if we let 2 of these managers lean towards where they really feel called?
Yeah.
And not define that super clearly, but instead say, you know, go out and do it. You know, because the church can maintain itself to a large degree.
Yeah.
To support directions like that.
Have you ever done formal community organizing work or training?
I don't think so. I did a Master of Social Work that I think I pulled skills in from.
Because a lot of what you're saying sounds like things that I hear community organizers say.
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Our congregation for the last 3 or 4 years has been helping to build an Industrial Areas Foundation organization here in the Inland Empire of Southern California, and that's how IAF folks talk. I mean, they talk about connecting with people on a one-on-one basis and finding out what really they're passionate about, and then helping sort of develop their own power to do that thing.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to that, that definitely resonates with me. Yeah, yeah. And the way that's made me think differently about the work of a pastor is you're not just sitting in an office, managing, like you said, an institution, or even like a nonprofit organization. You have to be going out and finding what new things are happening and figuring out ways to partner with people to make those happen. So,
yeah, absolutely. You know, I came into the office. This is the only time I've been in the office is to come in and do this podcast.
Oh, you're in your office to do this? How official.
I know. I would have let
you do it at home. I'm at home.
Oh, no, I was downtown. I was in the co-working space, coffee shops. I mean, that's where I spend most of my time is doing stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not always received well by the institution because people would like me to be in my office. They could stop by anytime they want.
So you do get some flack from people in your congregation for the amount of time that you spend out in the community. Like work time.
From time to time, you know, I think there's some, and I only hear whispers of it. How I have my priorities set up. Questioning how I prioritize what's important. You know, I don't go to every committee meeting. I just don't. And hear from that sometimes. But if it's, you know, they have choices, you know, as I have choices. So as long as we can live in that tension, I think it's okay.
And are you on your own in that way of working there at the church, or is that, I mean, do you have backup from, say, a head of staff or somebody else?
Yeah, there's a head of staff. He's new. Chris Neufeld Erdman, and we've had numerous conversations. You know, he's like, I feel this deep calling to go and sit at this cafe and just talk with people. You know, my response is that I think we're at this pivotal time in the church where we've got to be explicit and say, you know, I'm not going to be doing things the way that the previous 30-year pastors of the last 30 years have been doing it, because we're not at that place anymore. It's like we need to change our job descriptions to look very different. You know, if pastors wouldn't say, for example, there was a proposal that pastors don't attend any committee meetings unless there's something very explicit that they need to be present for, that would change things.
Indeed. I'll look forward to that proposal from you.
Hey, I'm working on one right now, so we'll see.
All right, I'm gonna watch carefully all the different things that you're working on because I find them really interesting, and I learn by listening to you, and the TED Talk that you did and the stuff that you're working on is challenging. I don't think that some of it I'm not all the way where you're at, but it's helping me think. Helping me think differently about things. And I hope that for people who are listening to this, it's doing the same thing. I mean, I think that your talk at the church in March was very challenging for people to think about a social enterprise model as opposed to a nonprofit model. I think that's a totally new idea for people, and I'm glad you're out there advocating it.
Yeah, and who knows if it's going to work. I mean, that's the thing is...
That's part of it, right? Yeah.
Concepts.
Yeah. I said that's part of it, is that it could fail. That's maybe one of the criteria for whether or not something is worth doing is could it fail? And if it can't possibly fail, then it's not worth doing.
Could be. That's right. Not enough risk to it.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Bill. I appreciate your time, and I look forward to seeing what you do next.
Hey, thanks so much, Rocky. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to the Yo Rocco podcast this week. Thanks to Bill Hobbick for his time and his generous conversation. As always, you can email me at rockycpc@gmail.com with any thoughts or suggestions that you might have about the podcast. I welcome those. You can also find the full archive of the previous 11 Yo Rocco podcast episodes by going to yorocco.com and clicking on the Yo Rocco podcast tab at the top of the page. That page has got all of the previous episodes archived there that you can actually listen to right there on the page, so I encourage you to do that. Our introduction at the beginning of the podcast was recorded by the terrific Brian Ellison, and the theme music that you've been hearing was composed and recorded by Landon Witsit, a.k.a. Go to Sleep John Darling, who you can find on SoundCloud, who's written a bunch of really cool stuff that you should go listen to. So thanks for listening. Until next week, take care.